Thank you. Am I working? You can hear me in the back? It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to thank you. I'm from Seattle and moved to Madison 3 years ago in Wisconsin, and I know you ordered up this weather just for me. It feels fabulous. I came from Florida where it was 85 and humid, and to come into this kind of weather just made me feel at home. I also feel funny wearing a tie because in InterVarsity we don't wear ties, but I was told to be a little more stiff, so I go back to my professorial days, and I think I'll be fine. I've never been to DTS before, but I do have connections. The pastor who mentored me and then married my wife and me 26 years ago near Seattle is a DTS alum. My current pastor in Madison is a DTS graduate. And as I found out, the first president of InterVarsity in 1941, Stacy Woods, is a DTS alum. And I was sleeping last night in the dorm where he lived. So it is an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've thought highly of this seminary for many years, and it's a kind of a thrill to be invited. So thank you all. It's good to be here. My talk is going to have two parts. So the nice thing when a speaker tells you where he or she is going, you kind of know when to wake up, and you get to the second half. The second half is shorter than the first half, so you know you're almost there by the time I finish the first half. I want to talk about five legacies of InterVarsity that I've inherited as a new president, for which I'm very thankful. And I think these are legacies that have helped and spoken into the church as well. And the second, I want to talk a little about our vision for the future and where we're going. So let me start with five legacies. And the first one is, I am thankful for the legacy of our British roots. And let me explain a little bit about this. After World War I, in 1919, there were Christian student groups. These were a bunch of 19 and 20-year-olds meeting at Oxford and Cambridge. And they decided they were going to have fellowship on campus, whatever their church membership was. And they formed InterVarsity, which meant between two campuses. So sometimes people think we're an athletic ministry, you know, InterVarsity, but actually it's this British part of us. And what's interesting about InterVarsity, it then spread to the continent. So you go through Europe and up to Scandinavia, even to China and Australia. And then it came to Canada and then to the United States almost belatedly. We were about the eighth or ninth, I think, country to form InterVarsity student chapters. And what's wonderful about that is we are British, and so we kind of escaped the 20s and 30s, which were problematic in American Christianity, and we never had that false dichotomy of pitting the heart against the mind, piety against the intellect. As one historian notes, the British heritage of InterVarsity served it to great advantage. Student work was seen as an import, and as such, it did not have ties to anything that was suspect to either the conservatives or the liberals. In his introduction, Mike mentioned IFES, and that stands for, this is a mouthful, International Fellowship of Evangelical Students. And I think if there were a branding, a person who liked branding in 1947 when IFES was formed, they wouldn't have come up with that long. But basically, IFES is about, now, it's about 150 national movements of InterVarsity types. So they may come under different names, but we're a federation. So when I go to World Assembly every 4 years, I'm meeting with the General Secretary, as they're called, because again, this is British. We call ourselves presidents in the U.S. because General Secretary doesn't communicate much to the general world here. But I meet with a guy from Guatemala, from Jordan, from Sierra Leone, everywhere. It's absolutely fabulous. And what's interesting about InterVarsity's British heritage is because we're not an American movement, our headquarters is not here in the U.S., that is the international headquarters, it's in Oxford. So I get the pleasure once a year, I'm going off next week, it's kind of one of the joys of my job. So I was thinking about this principle of indigeneity, and InterVarsity and IFES, this is old news, we've been doing this for years. So before the war in Iraq broke out, it was the Jordanian student movement that was sending student workers into Iraq, holding Bible studies and working there. And so the American role is somewhat reduced in a good way, I think. And of course, this is where missions has moved in the last 50 years, but that was the basis of how we started. I think our British roots also explain why John Stott and Martin Lloyd-Jones are our patron saints. Explains why, and that's an interesting combination for those of you who know the two of them. It explains why we're so comfortable crossing denominational boundaries, why expository preaching and inductive Bible study are so ingrained in our culture, why we place such an emphasis on student leadership. We've always said that the students are the ones who run the campus chapters. It explains why graduate students, our ministry to graduate students is exploding. We're up to about 15-20% of our students are now grad students, and why our faculty ministry is also flourishing. and why only 6 years after InterVarsity was founded in the U.S., InterVarsity Press was created. I find that to be so audacious. Here they have maybe a dozen staff and spread all around the U.S., and they start a publishing company. And one of the best part of my job is I get free InterVarsity Press books as they're published. I have a lot of friends. So we owe the Brits a lot. It almost makes me want to sing God Save the Queen. Let's not do it now. The second legacy, and I think this is where I want to talk a little bit more to you, is our affirmation, which is, I think, the affirmation of the Church Universal, of the lordship of Christ over the secular university. If you've read the history of secular universities in the United States, you know that even as late as 100 years ago, the president would typically teach a course, a capstone course on moral philosophy, and bring in the scriptures into that. But what's happened over time, of course, that's eroded. What's wonderful about InterVarsity is because we're organically grown out of the soil of the university. We've never viewed it as a hostile or foreboding place. We consider ourselves to be insiders. And we like to use the following illustration to explain our perspective on it. It's like the university is like a pond. And rather than just pulling fish out, which is one philosophy, that you go after the students who are the fish, we love the pond itself. We love the eco-culture. We love the water. And so we care about the faculty, we care about the campus culture, we care about the ideas, we care about the books that are used. And we are foolish enough to believe that that is a transforming mission of what we're about. I like that very much. And hence we were surprised a couple years ago of the conflicts we're now facing on campus. I think this will be relevant to some of you in later ministries. We found ourselves on the fault line of faith and culture, for example, at Rutgers University, where we were a recognized campus group and for a while, and then we were told we had to sign a statement that we wouldn't discriminate based on religion in the choice of our student leaders. Let me say that again. InterVarsity Christian Fellowship Rutgers could not have Christian leaders. We thought that was rather silly, and we were kicked off campus. We weren't able to post our notices. We didn't have meeting rooms. And so probably for the first time in our history, we're not a litigious ministry. We filed suit against Rutgers. And this hit Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, Wall Street Journal. It was a nice splash for a new president. You may have noticed in my introduction, I'm a lawyer, but I went to work for World Relief, so I'm not a litigator. But what happened there was we had to take a stand. It wasn't about our rights. It was about the lordship of Christ. It was another push over the last century of Christianity and Christians off campus. Our next challenges will be at places like Harvard, University of North Carolina, University of Pittsburgh, Ohio State, where the next train that's coming with our name on it will be the gay student who signs our doctrine of faith but wants to be in leadership. 30% of our students are non-Christians. They come of all ilks and stripes. We have ministries all over the place. But this has been a challenging time for us, and we appreciate your prayers. As I mentioned, this is not about our rights. It's about the lordship of Christ. We don't want to see him excluded, demoted, or made irrelevant on secular campuses. The good news at Rutgers is they backed off. They made the case moot. And so far, we've been successful. But InterVarsity, for whatever reasons, has been kind of a weather vane. I think once we got out there, we've been in that realm. I like to quote Abraham Kuyper, the Reformed theologian, who says, "There's not a square inch of the entire creation about which Jesus Christ does not cry, 'This is mine, this belongs to me.'" InterVarsity, we claim the secular campus for Christ. That's our mission field, our calling, and we're really going after it. Our third legacy that's been passed down and will continue to be passed down is our passion for the lost. There are 16 million college students in the United States today, including a freshman at Georgetown, my daughter. And I think about her all the time. And you know, you take your kid off to campus and you drop her off, and you just want the best for her. You hope she'll find a good church. You also hope she'll find fellowship on campus. As I mentioned, we are drawing an amazing pool of non-Christians. 30% of our students now are non-Christians. And there's a hunger there, but there's a hunger of doing apologetics in a different way. And reaching them has to be done very carefully. One of the joys of my job is that I receive email from various staff on a monthly basis. And one I got last year from a SUNY school up in Upper New York, it was fabulous. And let me tell you a little bit about it. The student leaders had, in the summertime, prayed, worked together, and really said, "We're going to go after campus this year." Then they came back in the fall, and they held secret meetings, dorms talks. They organized a Jesus Week with outside speakers. They prayed, and they were intentional about bonding with their non-Christian friends. And at the end of the year, 24 new believers had come into the kingdom. You know, we're on 565 campuses, and these kind of stories are very exciting. In the video you saw, there was something called a GIG, a group investigating God. Well, that's a neutral term for non-Christians to come into an inductive Bible study. And the rule of thumb is that half the students have to be unbelievers. That's the general rule of thumb. And I got a West Coast email that reads as follows. Tuesday is my favorite night of the week. Every Tuesday I get together with Alice, Starsky, Ann, Ian, and Britta to study the Gospels. The group is composed of a Buddhist, an atheist, an agnostic, a nominal Christian, and an active Christian. However, every week as we gaze at Jesus, I see people moving closer to the kingdom of God. And when I was in Seattle as a dean, I held a Friday night International Student Bible Study, and for 3 years living in Madison, I haven't done that. And I began to feel as I read these emails, my soul was eroding. So this quarter, I'm now meeting one-on-one with a Chinese graduate student. He's a postdoc from Shanghai. He's in AIDS. His PhD is in AIDS. He's a fabulous guy. And we're studying the Gospel of John. So once again, I'm blessed by this guy who's never read a Bible. He's just picking it up. What does it mean? The Word became flesh. What does it mean that the Word was with God and was God? And it is so touching. So GIGs, or it's an old strategy. I know a lot of you have been involved with inductive Bible studies with non-Christians, but it's still our part and parcel of what we do. We're also concerned and continue to be concerned, as you are, about the lost globally. And one of the stories that I like to tell is that in the late 1980s, when the wall came down in the Soviet Union, a number of American students went to the Ukraine, and they taught English, and they did Bible studies. It's a very traditional, typical method. Well, out of those summers, there were two or three summers where a lot of our students went, a national movement started in the Ukraine, and today there are 30 staff, Ukrainian staff. I'm not talking about expatriates. I'm talking about Ukrainian staff. The general secretary there, Victor, is 32 years old, and it's a fabulous ministry. They're on most of the major universities now in the Ukraine doing student ministry. You also heard reference to Urbana, the student missions conference that we hold every 3 years, and we've held it at the University of Illinois, Champaign, for 55 years. We are moving it in 2006 to St. Louis. That should send shockwaves. I mean, new president comes in and moves Urbana. You know, it's sort of holy ground. The reason is it's just gotten too small. We've outgrown the university, and you know, we hope to grow it in St. Louis and reach more students. Maybe if we can cut our costs, we can get more students to come. One of my favorite Urbana stories involves when I wasn't even on staff. I was traveling in Singapore before I became president, and I met with a woman there, a Chinese woman, and I found out she's a professor at the university, and she was chair of the InterVarsity Equivalent Board, the IFES board there. And when I found out she was Canadian and single, and all of her family lived in Toronto, I said, "What are you doing here?" She smiled, and she said, "Well, in 1970, I was a shy 19-year-old student. I went to the Urbana Convention. The Lord called me into the academy and into missions, and that's why I'm here." And I thought, you know, you look at the fruit 30-some years later of what the Lord has done through missions. Steve Hainer, my predecessor, estimates that about one-third of the missionaries that have been sent out in the last 50 years were impacted by Urbana directly or indirectly. It's been a tremendous hinge on which the Lord has helped swing the door of history, and we're just so pleased to be the stewards of it. The fourth legacy is our commitment to ethnic reconciliation and justice. And I want to tell you a story about InterVarsity, because I think this was very significant in our history, and I think in North American Christian Church. In the late 1940s in New York City, we had a staff member who was working both with Columbia University, which was predominantly white, and Hunter College, which was predominantly black. And she brought a mixed group for a Bible study to a trustee's home. And the trustees pulled her aside and said, "What are you doing here?" Now remember, this is Jim Crow. Even though it's North, it's still a bad time. And the worker said, "Well, the gospel calls me to do this." And the trustee said, "Well, I don't think this," and then she hesitated. She said, "I'm going to talk to the board about this." And what I love is this 25-year-old staff looked back at the trustee who could have her fired and basically gave her a dirty, hairy look and said, "Make my day." And so it went to the board. The board unanimously went with the staff member. I've never read what happened to the board member. I assume she moved on. But InterVarsity broke this color line early on. And in a January article in Christianity Today, this is a quote. InterVarsity is one organization that has actively pursued multi-ethnicity. Today, 35% of the students involved identify themselves as ethnic minorities, which compares favorably to the national average of 27% of all college students. So we feel we've been, and again, this is a legacy that I've inherited, I'm not taking any credit, but a bit prophetic in this area. Urbana 2003 had 45% people of color. One of my, again, I'll give you another quote here. This is a Lebanese immigrant who's on staff with us. Actually, he's second generation, but his parents are Lebanese. And he says, "Here I am, a Lebanese guy co-leading with a Chinese woman, 25 students in the Word, 21 of whom are African-American, and they're eating it up." On the other side, we have another ethnic ministry to Greek students, that is fraternities and sororities. And I call it ethnic because it's virtually all white. You know, Greek students, and our president and most of the past presidents, Supreme Court justices and senators, a lot of them are Greeks. But we are working with Greeks because they are lost people who need the Lord. And last spring break, 50 of our students at a Greek chapter at Northern Illinois University traveled to Georgia to volunteer for Habitat. And six of their group were non-Christians. And they not only built the houses, but then at night they would do Bible studies with the other volunteer groups, the secular groups that were there. And they served as chaplains. It's a very nice thing. And what was great about this story is that on the way back, two of the six became Christians because of this experience. And this story, for the white students, it was an exposure to going and seeing Confederate flags, to going into the Deep South. So it involved racial reconciliation, evangelism, service, justice, the poor. It's sort of the whole package in terms of an integrated gospel. The fifth and final legacy is our commitment to the church. And I think this is a very important point that I want to make to you today. Recently, we had a pastor come in from Madison and talk to our leadership team. And he said, you know, InterVarsity has a high ecclesiology. And it took me a moment to get what he was saying. But we respect the church. We are not the church. We are a missionary organization. And as we've scrambled to try to figure out what exactly our theology, scrambled isn't the right word, we've thought about this for a long time, but as we've pondered it, Ralph Winter, missiologist, about 35 years ago, wrote a paper that was very helpful. And he said that through history, God has promoted the kingdom through two basic structures, modality and sodality. Let me define those terms. Familiar terms? I probably see some nodding heads on the side. Nodding in a good way, not sleeping, but nodding positively. Modality represents the local church, the parish. Sodality represents a specialized ministry. And when you look at the Catholic Church and the history back with the Franciscans and the Jesuits, those would be sodalities. And really, when you look at from William Carey on with the modern missions movement, it's been sodalities that have really helped inspire. So Ralph Winter's point is you need both of these to work together. And both, and particularly the sodality, needs to respect the role of the modality. And a sodality is capable of being laser-focused. And these are missionary societies that target a particular group. In our case, that's college students. And as a sodality, again, I say we are an arm of the church. And so we work in partnership with the church. I also think we can act as advanced scouts. Think of Caleb and Joshua for the church. With youth culture. I mean, we're on campus, and so when you think about postmodernism and you're thinking about evangelism or worship, we are right there on campus. We're picking up on what's going on with now the millennial students, and it's a great place to be. So those are some legacies. Let me move on to the second part. I told you that you'd get here, and then you'd know you could snap. I know you were up late last night like me. To vision. And where do we see, where are we going? And I think as I tried to articulate the vision, it really comes in two parts. We have a micro vision and a macro vision. The micro vision is the character of each student that we interact with, that we want to prepare students for lives of faith in the marketplace, in the church, and in the kingdom. We adhere to the teaching of Richard Niebuhr in this sense that ours is a theology of transformation. I mentioned in the tape we want to create change agents. So what do we want to our alumni to look like? Well, we want them to be people of personal piety, who love God, who embrace prayer and spiritual formation, people with scriptural depth. I mean, it's always been a trademark of InterVarsity to love scriptures, people know how to lead and feed others. We want our alums to be people with strong leadership skills, who are able to see a need, mobilize people, and reach it. We want them to be people of heartfelt justice, who feel passion for the poor and the disenfranchised. We want them to be people who are missional in their focus, whether it's their office mate at work or an agnostic in Mongolia. We want them to be people who prize Ethnic Reconciliation, who are excited about the Revelation 7 community and able to navigate within it. We want them to be people who love the mind, who read widely and diligently seek to integrate their faith and their intellect, who understand the lordship of Christ in the broadest sense. And we want them to be people who are deeply committed to a local church as elders, Sunday school teachers, and missions. I was talking with one of your alums last night who used to work for us, and he was saying at Dallas that character development and spiritual formation are very important. So we are certainly on the same journey together. All right, and then the macro vision. What do we see in the future? I have to include evangelism because even though it's one of our legacies, it's clearly all of our calls with the Great Commission. Let me give you a couple of other examples of just encouraging stories. When I get these, they kind of make my day. At the University of Reno at Nevada, probably not known as a spiritual hotbed, it's not where you would go to think about finding a revival. A couple years ago, we had a group of upper division students, 21, 22-year-olds, who covenant together to move back into the dorms as missionaries. And as a result of their praying and working, they moved into the freshman dorm, which I think is a horrific sacrifice. I mean, once I got out of the freshman dorm, I never wanted to go back. But these folks went back, and at the end of the year, there were 15 freshmen who had made faith commitments. I mentioned our ministry to Greek students, and last February, I went to Indianapolis, and in a crowd of 700 students, I saw 75 stand up for a profession of faith. The year before, it had been 100. I tell you, the fields are white on the college campus. You have to know how to do it, and our strategies are as wide as our campus staff in terms of where they, how they do it, but the fields are white indeed. Our goal is to have as many non-Christian Bible studies as we do small groups for Christians and to raise up the next generation of campus evangelists. We also want to be on more campuses. We're currently on about 565, and we're looking to add 50 in the next few years. But the question that we're addressing is this: do we go after the large campuses that are already saturated with campus ministries? At UCLA, where we have a vibrant ministry, for example, there are 80 campus ministries, 80. You go down the block to University of California, Dominguez Hills, a predominantly Latino black campus with first-generation students, there are two ministries, InterVarsity and Occult. And we are facing strategically, where do we go? How do we meet this need? Commuter campuses, two-year schools, tribal colleges. Another strategy, another goal for us is to connect with more niche groups. This is the fastest aspect of our ministry growing. International student ministries have grown 70% over the last decade. Now, with 9/11 and the subsequent visa issues, I see some international students. I'll probably see some nodding heads. We'll see where this goes, but we're very excited about that. Grad students, again, great growth. And faculty, we have several faculty that we work with and with ethnic minorities. So I like to say when we talk about niche ministries that we love the Greeks and the geeks, we love athletes and artists, we love engineers and economists, Asian Americans and African Americans, Latinos and Latin majors. So let me conclude. Those are some of the things we're working on, and I'm thankful for the legacies that have been passed down through the years, and I'm very excited about the future, that we have both micro and macro visions. I'm going to be around all day, and I would love to converse with you if you have any interest in joining your varsity staff, if you're interested in overseas service, if you're going into the pastorate and you want to talk about how we might partner together and help each other. We bring students, because that's our goal. I mean, we require all our staff to be active members in the church, and we encourage all our students in that direction as well. And let me close with a quote from the former president of the UN General Secretary. He said, "Change the university, and you change the world." May the Lord in his graciousness use each of us to impact the next generation. Thank you.